welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm happy to present a book that I think a lot of you might be interested in. This is Higher Education Beyond Job Creation, Universities, Citizenship, and Community. And this book is by Thomas Breyer, who is the director of the Center for Public and Nonprofit Management at the University of Central Florida and an associate professor in the university's School of Public Administration. And this book really looks at the university and what it could be from a standpoint of civic development and community engagement, and really kind of bases the book in a very strong academic foundation, but as well as real world classroom and experience that Dr. Breyer's had in the past, and brings in a lot of real world organizations and initiatives and things like that. So I'm happy to have Dr. Breyer with us today. Welcome, Dr. Breyer.
Thank you so much.
And if we can just begin, can you kind of tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you got into this kind of academic area and focus?
Absolutely. Well, I have I've been at the University of Central Florida in the School of Public Administration for 7 years now, and UCF is a unique institution. It's actually the second largest university in the United States by enrollment, with about 64,000 students. Which presents some unique challenges as well as some very unique opportunities for thinking about how we can link the university students and professors and staff into the community, and then we'll talk more about that. But as I said, I've been at the university for about 7 years, joining the faculty in 2007. In 2000 and about 3 years ago, 2011, I became director of our Center for Public and Nonprofit Management. And the center is essentially the research arm and the community engagement arm of the School of Public Administration. It's our job to ensure that the work we do, the research of our students, of our faculty, the teaching of our research and faculty is ultimately impactful for the community around us in Central Florida and beyond. And indeed, as a center, we've just launched some significant international initiatives, global initiatives. So we're really seeing our impact on a global level right now. And again, we'll talk more about what kind of impact that is, how we measure that impact in a little bit. But I came to UCF by way of University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and it was there that I really developed the strong sense of community and the orientation to community that is so part of my identity as a professor right now. I see it as a fundamental mission for anybody in academia to think beyond the four walls of their classroom or the limits of the course website to how we can integrate with and help transform the communities around us. And that's an orientation that was developed in my time as a doctoral student at Southern California and continues very much in my work at Central Florida.
Yeah, and I think you can definitely read it in the book when you're going through it and really feel that passion for civic engagement and community. So you can really read it within the book. So, but you know, getting into the book, you know, why did you write this book? What was the impetus? And I think you kind of put it in sort of the first chapter. What's at stake? And so I'll ask you, what is at stake?
Absolutely. It's, you know, higher education in the U.S. today, as around the world, is very much at a crossroads. There's quite a bit of political rhetoric and pressure from state governments, from governors in a variety of states, as well as from the White House and the Obama administration. The same pressures are being faced in other countries as well. I just returned last week, actually, from a month traveling around Eastern Europe, spent some time in Lithuania and Romania and some other places, and professors there explain the same basic tension, which is a push on higher education to focus on STEM disciplines, your science, technology, engineering, and math disciplines, and to really apply market mechanisms to the management and the measurement of success for higher education. And so what I hope this book is in, at least at one level, a response to that rhetoric, to present an alternative view of what is possible with higher education, as the title suggests, beyond job creation, that it's that higher education has a purpose and a function that can be so much more powerful if we integrate across the different historical purposes and current demands of these institutions around the country, you know, around the world today. And what's at stake is it failure to act, failure to think strategically about integrating across, creating jobs, being an economic engine, cultivating citizens, disseminating knowledge, developing skills of our citizens throughout our community. If we don't think strategically about how to do this, then we will irrevocably change the look and character and feel of higher education institutions, not only in the next few years, but for a generation or more to come, if we focus too much, too singularly on the economic side of higher education, the job creation side of higher education.
Right. And I think some of those narratives that are talked about in that chapter, as you mentioned, sort of this chasing the STEM field and sort of the push for that, and maybe at the expense of some humanities or liberal arts or other things. And we also get a narrative that we see in quite a bit of literature is talking about, you know, chasing like a world-class university, or what does that mean? And, you know, kind of the challenges that we're facing today. And I think leading right into the second chapter, maybe a challenge that isn't being addressed by universities today, or potentially not in all universities, but some, are the decline of civics and sort of a weak community, a lack of interconnectedness. I think we use the term silos, where, you know, there's different departments that are very disconnected from each other. So maybe can you kind of explain how you sort of phrase that in the book, in chapter two?
Absolutely. And the title of the second chapter is maybe provocative, maybe not. It depends on who's reading it, I suppose. But the title is Civic Decline, Lust for Growth, and Weak Communities. And that, in my sense, summarizes the state of our broader societal institutions in the United States in particular, and really beyond our national boundaries as well. And so in the chapter, I talk about some trends that should be concerning to all of us within higher education and within and across other sectors of our society. One trend or set of trends is the social connectedness of our people. We have great declines in social trust within our citizenry. We see low levels of trust in neighbor across the country. For instance, in my home of Florida, it's approximately, I think, 11% of Floridians state that they trust none of the people in their neighborhood. Just think about that for a moment. 11% of Floridians say of the people living in the immediate area around them, they don't trust them. They don't trust them to look after their home if they're away. They don't trust them to watch over their kids. There's just a complete lack of social trust. And so that figure is 9% nationally. There are some variations regionally around the country. But this is a big concern. If we look at just a bit of a broader picture on that, asking Americans if they trust some of the people, maybe a handful, there are about, I think, 35% who say they trust some of the people. So that leaves really a relatively small portion. About 50% of the population can trust most of the people, and very few trust all of the people in their neighborhood. So we have a lot of distrust, a lot of active distrust, not only across people, but between the people and our government as well. We can look at political intelligence, what I call political intelligence in the chapter. Mm-hmm. Social science surveys from the Pew Center have found that, particularly among college-aged youth, they know more about the latest smartphone technology than they do about who the vice president of the United States is or any other significant need-to-know or good-to-know issues related to how things actually operate in a country, how a government works.
Right.
It suggests a disconnection from politics, a disconnection from government, a lack of understanding of how to advocate one's own interests and one's own causes, which is, when we think about the civic health of our nation, that's pretty bad if we don't know how to advocate for what we believe is good for us or our community. Then we're subject to great manipulation. Similarly, the social awareness of our citizens is declining over the past couple of decades. Empathy has been declining, mm-hmm. again, particularly among college-aged youth. I like to give the example of if I'm walking down the street and I see a homeless individual with a sign asking for food, asking for money, fewer and fewer of us as Americans, particularly among college-aged youth, are going to stop and help that person with some food or some money, at least because they feel they do not feel sympathy. They don't feel like they can see themselves in that person's shoes at some point in their life. They have no connection to that deprivation. To the extent that someone might stop and offer an assistance to that homeless individual, it will be because of a guilt. They'll help because if they don't, they'll feel guilty. It's a personal distress empathy, and that's the one form of empathy that has actually not been declining over the past couple of decades. And then, of course, we know the data on economics and financial security, particularly in the years following the recession here in the U.S. and outside of the U.S. So overall, our social connectedness is down, our political intelligence, our ability to advocate for our own interests is suffering. We don't feel like connection from an empathy perspective to each other, and we're not becoming the self-sufficient consumers that would be desirable from a societal perspective and a capitalist perspective as well. So on all counts, we've got some challenges, and what I argue is that higher education institutions can fire on all cylinders and in an integrated way make a difference on all of those measures.
Absolutely. And I believe in your following chapter, you kind of talk about sort of the initial historical conceptual development of the university and sort of what that meant and sort of how we got to where we're at today. And really, the question is, were universities supposed to be cultivators of citizens? As you lay it out, can you kind of talk about that chapter a little bit?
Absolutely, and then this was actually one of the more interesting chapters for me to research and to write, and I hope it's as enjoyable to read as it was to write. What I do in the chapter is present a history, a broad, somewhat of a brush history on how higher education has developed, dating from antiquity to very much 2013, 2014. And I would actually recommend a book that I cite in the chapter as another excellent book to read for anybody who's interested in this subject. Christopher Loss's 2012 book, Between the Citizen and the State. Just a really nice history of how universities have stood between the people, masses, the citizenry, and state institutions across our history. It's really a very interesting read. But what I do in the chapter is suggest how that history from antiquity to today has played within these four narratives of higher education, how has how have university institutions set up to cultivate citizenship? For instance, on the question of citizenship cultivation, we can look at the history of developing not citizens as active ethical citizens to advocate for interests, as I would like to talk about mostly today, but to preparing citizen soldiers to help secure the state. In the early years of the U.S. higher education institutions, the very first universities, the Harvards and so on, set up to not promote citizenship from a national perspective, to help preserve the faith element of the country and to develop leaders for continuing the work of the church and send your religious institutions in the years to follow. It's really an interesting history as we go from there to the Civil War period in U.S. history and onward to what Christopher Loss described as the rights-based citizenship era of higher education, which really start to see us identify individuals and individual identity as something worth cultivating. It's the job of universities to promote individualism, to promote individual identity. With that individual identity, each individual identity, I should say, contributing to the betterment of the whole of society. But overall, whether the purpose of citizenship is to fight in a war as a soldier or to develop religious institutions or to develop personal identity or to contribute as volunteers in community, the narrative of citizenship is the same, that citizens or the universities have a role to help create citizens who can give back to the state, can give back to society. And whatever form citizenship takes, that's been a continual thread or stream across our world history in many ways. But then we can look at the other histories of how universities have sought to develop knowledge, how universities have sought to disseminate knowledge that has been created by professors and by students and by staff at universities. The question here becomes knowledge for what purpose is important. And this is an answer that has shifted over time. Mm-hmm. Today, the dominant answer, the predominant answer, is knowledge is important only to the extent that it contributes to the building or development of our economies, to build jobs, to create jobs, to serve as an economic engine. If the knowledge is not being produced for that purpose, then some have questioned the legitimacy of that knowledge. For instance, I cite in the book, and I close the book with an extended quote from William Shakespeare. There are a pair of consultants here in Florida who submitted a report to the governor's task force on higher education reform, asking a question and citing a statistic that in the past, I forget the time period, 50 years or something, there have been 35,000 scholarly publications about Shakespeare or the works of William Shakespeare. And they ask in their report and in their recommendation to the governor's task force, why do we need 35,000 publications about Shakespeare or the works of Shakespeare? Wouldn't the first 1,000 have been enough? My response to that is, of course not. That's missing the point of why these works are valuable. They argue the point that these consultants by saying, well, they don't really contribute to jobs. They don't help build skills for the workforce of today or the workforce of tomorrow. And so we really have to shift the funding within our universities towards the disciplines and the knowledge creation and the knowledge dissemination that is more economically driven and away from these liberal arts ideas. But that, of course, is a tension. And what I suggest overall in the book as a major theme is that it's a tension that need not exist, that we can promote the economics as well as the more philosophical and the artistic and so forth and so on, in a way that contributes to both job creation and citizen development and skill development and so on. So overall in the chapter...
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, overall in the chapter, I present broad brush history on how universities have developed across these four narratives of higher education. I suggest some what I call ideal types, how these universities would function if they focus singularly in these one of these narratives at the expense of the others, and ultimately drawn to a conclusion that the smartest university, the most strategically placed and managed university, will be one that integrates rather than treats any one narrative as an ideal type or as a singular mission.
Right, right. And speaking of, you know, you're talking about these consultants who said, you know, the Shakespeare story. I mean, you also use a quote from Tom Coburn of my home state, Oklahoma, and he says, you know, why are we funding any research that doesn't directly relate to economic advancement or national defense of the country? And so, you know, these ideas are pervasive. It's not just consultants; these are, you know, the people who are in charge of our country. And so, you know, I hope, you know, maybe someone like a Coburn reads this and can get a different idea, perhaps. So let's go into your...
Yeah, and that's certainly...
Go ahead.
Please, go ahead.
I was going to say, we can, you know, go into your next chapter that really sort of talks about the ways that a university can... the next section of your book really talks about the ways that universities can cultivate this civic engagement and interconnectedness. And if you want to talk about sort of your conceptualization of the C-DEMOS, which stands for Student Empowered Education and Democratizing Education for Members of Society. So, you know, I know that's a quite a big acronym, but if you can let us know what that is and sort of what that means and why that's important.
Absolutely. And so... You know, so this is where the book started, actually, back maybe a couple of years ago. I was at a dinner party or something with some friends, and we were chatting about some ideas, and I wrote on the infamous napkin, the acronym CDOS, and all great books start on napkins, I suppose, right?
yeah. Right.
So this is where it started. I wrote down this acronym CDEMOS, Student Empowered Education and Democratizing Education for Members of Society, as sort of the core twin values for how higher education should approach its role in community. And I define the acronym as sort of a dual purpose acronym. So on one hand, we've already spelled it out a couple of times, but the words themselves have a meaning on their own. To see, C-E is clear enough that we need to, as a university, see beyond our traditional boundaries as institutions, to think more broadly about the community around us and the people in the communities around us. DEMOS is the masses. It's the people. So ultimately what I'm trying to communicate just with the acronym itself, that we need to see the people in our communities, in our society, not as our customers. I don't want to use the market or the market language here, but they are our responsibility. They are our obligation as institutions of higher education. So breaking the acronym down onto the two different pieces, the C, Student Empowered Education, I describe different approaches to empowering students, to give students some control over not only their educational experience, but also empowering students to feel the responsibility and to feel the reward of giving back to the community through their studies, through their educational process. And so I talked some about the idea of service learning and the idea of living learning communities on university campuses and residence halls as initiatives to invest in students that, again, that felt responsibility, that felt obligation, that they are not in university just for themselves. They're not in university just to get a bigger paycheck at the end of 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, or whatever the case may be. That they are in university in order to help develop their own sets of values, their own skills, so that they can help others achieve similar aims, and they can help lift up communities around them, not only within their university region, but around the world. That's the intent there through empowerment of students. And on the side of democratizing education for members of society, the issue here is to include the university, the broader community in research activity and teaching activity and service activity. I'll give an example, I think I may talk about the example at more length in a later chapter, but within the Center for Public and Nonprofit Management, we host an AmeriCorps VISTA project. VISTA is Volunteers in Service to America. And it's a program of the Corporation for National Community Service, a federal government agency. The idea of VISTA is that individual citizens will give a year of their life to full-time volunteer service. While they're serving in that year, they're forbidden from any external employment. They make a modest living allowance, just very slightly poverty level. The idea is that while they're serving those in poverty through their volunteerism, they are actually living in poverty themselves. As a university, as a Center for Public and Nonprofit Management, we see it as our obligation to host this VISTA project help push our expertise and our knowledge about, in this case, a nonprofit and government capacity building issues into the community to change the lives of people within the community. Our VISTA project is focused on K-12 student education, homeless student education. Within the Central Florida region, we have about 15,000 homeless students in our local school districts. That represents about 3% of the overall student population here in Central Florida school districts. We see it as our obligation to give back to the community through our research, through our teaching, through our service activity. This is a grant. Universities don't often like to see grants and projects that are unfunded, particularly that take up a lot of time of staff and professors. But UCF, I think, is very unique in this regard, and I celebrate my institution for this. We consider this grant a service grant. We are getting a little bit of money from the Corporation for National Community Service, but not enough to cover all of our expenses and costs associated with it. So this is really a service grant, a responsibility grant, I would say, to give back. And the last example that I think I would give from this chapter that I think is interesting is I include a very short essay from one of our students at the university, Alice Nira, who I think exemplifies the kind of student that we want to cultivate through our higher ed institutions. She's not one of my students, actually. She's in the political science and education programs at the university. But she has successfully navigated across units of the university, engaged professors from multiple units of the university to propel her passion, which is educate not only UCF students, but the broader community about homelessness and hunger within Central Florida and around the world. And so she has been organizing an annual hunger banquet at the university that, again, successfully engages students, professors, staff, and outside community members so that everyone can become more knowledgeable about the privileges that most of us at the university enjoy, as well as the the scarcity that exists not far outside of our university walls, and then of course beyond the walls of the university around the globe. So what I emphasize in this chapter is the need for empowered education, the need for empowering students, and the need for seeing clearly outside of our borders lifting up and educating and empowering community members, even those who are not tuition paying students.
Absolutely. And you basically talked quite a bit about connecting the two chapters, but the next chapter really gives people the pedagogy to understand sort of what you're what you're trying to argue in the book, and you kind of talked about that a little bit. If you want, sort of maybe kind of talk a little bit about sort of the idea of service learning as an important step in this process, if you can.
Absolutely, and service learning is not a new idea. It's sometimes not implemented in a way that's beneficial for all parties involved. And that's what I try to respond to in this chapter. Sometimes service learning is treated as purely instrumental act where students apply a skill learned in the classroom to an organization or a need in the community. But oftentimes that's where the relationship ends. And so community organizations or community members may actually be harmed in the process, and the trust that's so vital between universities and communities can suffer if that's the extent of the relationship. What I define in the fifth chapter is what I call joined up service learning. Service learning that brings together, in this case, through an extended case example, the university and a graduate level class at the university, specifically a local Title I high school, and then other community organizations that come together with the shared goal of rebuilding a high school that is going through a redevelopment to become a wraparound service community school, a school that is not limited to 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. typical school day activities, but includes access to medical care, job training, and referral services, and other social services, not only for the students, but the parents of the students at the school. And so this is a joined-up service learning model that's brought some of my students together with some high school students at this school, engaged them in joint learning activities, joint classroom activities, and ultimately a joint research activity, collecting survey data, focus group data, community observation, and photographic data, so that we would ultimately develop some very clear, targeted and actionable recommendations for changing the school and changing the community around the school to benefit not only the students but the community as a whole. I enjoy the case. I include the case in the book because it was very powerful for me to teach that class and to go outside of my own boundaries and teaching and working with high school students in a low-income community is something that I had not experienced before designing and teaching this style of class. But it certainly paid dividends. We saw results in terms of the felt empowerment of the students, both on the graduate student university side as well as the high school side. I particularly enjoyed a quote from one of the high school students who wrote unsolicited in a journal that I had the students keep in the process. And if I can, I'll just read quickly the quote.
Sure.
And it's just that I cherish very much. I have the original handwritten quote on a notebook paper framed and hanging on my office wall.
Oh.
It really inspired me to keep doing this sort of thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
But the student says, "Thank you for the opportunity to..." She says, "Thank you for the opportunity to be part of the community school focus group process. I speak on behalf of Evans High students when I say we appreciate your efforts to try to make our school not feel like a school, but a home. And for that, we are grateful." We know that you do not have to do these things for us. Most people do not know us and do not know how great we can be, the things we can do, or our talents and hopes and dreams that we hold. They don't know that we go through what we go through and the pain and struggles that we deal with. Evan is my home. I walk these halls and I see my brothers and sisters fall. They fall into the temptations and cruelty of this world. I see how great and stunning they are, things other people will never see. So on behalf of my family, I say, thank you, UCF, thank you. And that's just, I think, just a case of one, an N of one, that says this kind of work, this kind of student-empowered education can really change lives and make a difference beyond the four walls of the traditional university.
Absolutely. That's a very moving entry. And I'm sure when you see that stuff, it kind of helps you keep on doing some of these things and moving forward on that. I guess, you know, moving forward for time's sake, your next chapter kind of, it's all connected, obviously, but how can institutions really sustain these partnerships and really become ingrained in a community? And what maybe have you guys been doing over there to do that?
Absolutely. So the way I like to think about it within the Center for Profit Management, in both evaluating and assessing our work, as well as choosing the projects that make the most strategic sense for us, is to align the projects along the four narratives that I've described. To what extent does the project, does the research, does the service, does the teaching develop citizens? To what extent does it create jobs? To what extent does it create or disseminate knowledge? And to what extent does it train workers? And in the chapter, I had a number of different examples. I won't go into detail on any of them. Excuse me. I've already talked about the AmeriCorps Vista project as one primary example. We also host a walking school bus program out of our center that builds capacity of local communities to encourage American school students and their families to walk to school within a 2-mile radius of their assets, on car lot to get to school. And I provide some other examples as well. But ultimately, what I look for in this chapter and what I try to describe in this chapter is our set of criteria for how to choose projects and how to evaluate projects using these four narratives. Above all, in order to sustain these kinds of initiatives institutionally, and I may be bleeding in this conversation to other types of other chapters, and if I am, I apologize, but what's most important is developing first a trust relationship between university and community, and that takes time and takes patience and a lot of frustration sometimes. But it also takes a very strong culture up and down the hierarchy within the university that, again, is not too singularly focused on any one mission or any one silo of the university. If we truly want to strengthen communities, change lives, which is the slogan for the College of Health and Public Affairs at the University of Central Florida, if we truly want to strengthen communities and change lives, then we need to integrate. We need leadership to use the language of integration and the language that is, again, beyond job creation, beyond market mechanisms and the management and strategic direction for the institution.
Absolutely. If we could, I know we have a couple minutes left on the podcast, but you know, you talk about in the seventh chapter titled A New Model for Higher Education, you talk about performance funding for universities and sort of how they are, you know, funded by the state, and there's like a formula. And we actually did a podcast on this a book in the past, but you kind of lay out sort of what your ideal funding model would be. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that and what we should be placing importance on?
Absolutely. Performance funding is so vital. As if taken to its full implementation, it can change the entire image and direction of a university, and sometimes not for the better. So, for instance, at the universities in Florida right now, we have performance funding, not for a substantial part of the budget, but for some, tied to the average salary of alumni, for instance, as one measure. And that's okay as an important measure, but again, it's a market measure, it's an economic measure, it's a job creation measure that is not all inclusive of the various missions of the university, the integrated mission of the university. And so what I propose in the chapter are a set of potential indicators and measures for how we can tie budgets to what we want to achieve in the university. So on the job creation side, I don't ignore that. I say that's still important. The title of the book is Beyond Job Creation. It's not instead of job creation. Job creation is still very, very important for universities. But I propose indicators that are more inclusive. For instance, not only looking at average alumni salary, we can look at the percentage of alumni in public service careers, including nonprofit and government service careers. Typically, those salaries are lower in social service arenas and in the nonprofit and government work than in the private sector. And we should not penalize institutions for graduating students who have a passion and a commitment to serving the public in lower wage professions.
Right.
So we need to be more inclusive in those issues. Another example, the percentage of new businesses or nonprofit organizations that are created by students. So again, not penalizing students who choose the tough work of starting a non-government organization that is going to wallow in obscurity for many, many years potentially. And certainly where the founder might make a very modest salary driven more by passion. We have to recognize universities that develop students who will lead those social enterprises, those nonprofit organizations, as well as those who create very profitable potential future Fortune 500 companies. I suggest other measures for skill development and economic self-sufficiency of students that are important, and I won't go into detail on those, but again, that's capturing the other narrative of higher education. And then on the citizen cultivation, we ought to reward universities that have produce students, that produce alumni who are strong, active, ethical citizens, alumni who volunteer in the community, alumni who contribute a significant portion of their discretionary income to charity, alumni who are active voters in federal and local elections, and alumni who work within their community to change the community. All of these are vital aspects of the university, and any institution that graduates students who do not do these things, I think is failing as an institution. So we need to measure what we're doing there, how well we're doing it, and reward those institutions that are creating good, strong, ethical, active citizens. So that's the overall gist of the performance funding. It's more robust, it's not singularly focused, it's integrative, and is not biased in setting an agenda that is much more driven by the economics of the job market of today.
All right. That's great. And if any listeners out there are interested in perhaps checking out his recommendations, definitely you're going to want to read the book and that chapter specifically. So kind of wrapping up, you titled the last chapter Band of Brothers. Why did you decide to name it that? And any final thoughts on the book project?
Sure. Well, the title of the last chapter, Band of Brothers, is taken from Shakespeare's play, Henry V. And it's my last jab at those consultants who proposed 1,000 scholarly works about Shakespeare. Shakespeare's works was more than sufficient, and the rest are meaningless as they don't contribute to job creation. So this is the last final word in the last chapter is instead of the quote from Henry V. If you're familiar with Henry V, it's a wonderful play that and the speech that I conclude in the final chapter from Henry V, from King Henry V, really sums up the passion of what I think is necessary for transformation reform.
All right.
And that is passion that we can't do this individually. We can't do this work in silos. It has to be something that brings all these sides together.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that's a very a nice stamp on. I know we're kind of pressed for time a bit. So if you can just maybe briefly mention, you know, what's next for you? What's next for Dr. Breyer?
Absolutely. Well, I'm very, very excited to continue to work within the Center for Public and Nonprofit Management. And as I said at the beginning of the interview here, as a center, we are expanding some of our work into the global arena, working in Eastern Europe, some of the emerging EU nations where they're just developing some of their bureaucracies and thinking about the same issues of higher education governance as we are. And so we're looking more broadly in that regard. But of course, the work that I describe in the book and the philosophy that I describe in the book is going to continue to be my philosophy. As a professor in the U.S. and globally, we must always look beyond job creation. We must always look to the integrated path for higher education, because that's the only way that we can truly change the communities around us, which is, in my view, a pivotal mission of universities and institutions of higher education.
All right. Great, great. So we'll be looking forward to some of that research and maybe future publications from there. So to all the New Books in Education listeners on the New Books Network, thank you for listening. Go and check out the book from Dr. Thomas Breyer, Higher Education Beyond Job Creation, University Citizenship, and Community. And that's from Lexington Books. And thank you, Dr. Breyer. And I hope you guys learned something. Thank you.